So even when American presidents speak about our deep commitment to the spread of democracy worldwide, and we rail against other countries, Iran or Sudan, Venezuela, for their lack of democracy, we conspicuously ignore the total lack of democracy in Saudi Arabia year after year after year.
There are questions about how good a friend Saudi Arabia has really been to the U.S.
Experts and U.S. officials give the Saudis low marks, charging that they continue to export the ideology of terror. Human rights groups and Saudi dissidents also complain about the pace of reforms promised by King Abdullah, and say Saudi Arabia remains among the worst countries in the Middle East when it comes to religious freedom and rights of women. Saudi women still can't drive, can't vote, and can't work or get medical treatment without approval of a male relative.
We have historically chosen to overlook the fact that the royal family is a feudal monarchy that grants no rights whatsoever to its population. And we have created a very elaborate military establishment in Saudi Arabia, providing some of the most sophisticated arms in the world, providing military training to the kingdom, military advisors of stationing troops in the kingdom.
The modern Saudi military really is a creation of the United States. We've had military missions there for decades.
And there can be no explanation for that other than the fact that the royal family guarantees our access to Saudi Arabian oil.
In fact, when the United States sent troops to Saudi Arabia in 1990, after the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, then Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney told the Senate Armed Services Committee that the reason the United States was coming to the rescue of Saudi Arabia was because of the agreement between Roosevelt and Abdulaziz.
Our strategic interest in the Persian Gulf region, I think, are well known, but bear repeating today. We do, of course, have historic ties, especially to the Saudis, but other governments in the region, that hark back with respect to Saudi Arabia to 1945, when President Franklin Delano Roosevelt met with King Abdulaziz on the USS Quincy towards the end of World War II, and affirmed at that time that the United States had a lasting, continuing interest in the security of the kingdom.
And so this special relationship with Saudi Arabia has shaped American foreign policy since Roosevelt's day. We can see this in some of the most important presidential doctrines of the past 60 years.
Expansion of totalitarian interests in Europe and Asia, President Truman addresses a joint session of Congress on our changing foreign policy. A grave gathering hears his forthright message.
The gravity of the situation which confronts the world today necessitates my appearance before a joint session of the Congress.
With the Truman Doctrine, for example, what we understand is that the Soviet Union was posing a threat to Greece and Turkey. That's the official explanation, and that something had to be done to stop this.
The very existence of the Greek state is today threatened by the terrorist activities of several thousand armed men led by communists.
But Truman was really worried about Soviet efforts to dominate the Persian Gulf area and to control the flow of oil from the Persian Gulf. In fact, declassified documents show that the Truman administration was so concerned about a possible Soviet takeover of the Persian Gulf that they contrived plans to plug up Saudi Arabian oil fields in case the Soviets came in and took over the area and we were forced to abandon the region. But he was fearful that the American public wasn't ready for military intervention in the area, so he decided to couch this in terms of a vast Soviet conspiracy against free peoples around the world.
If we falter in our leadership, we may endanger the peace of the world, and we shall surely endanger the welfare of this nation.
and that became known as the Truman Doctrine. But if you look closely at the diplomatic history, you will find that what was really on the minds of American policymakers at the time was the possibility of a threat to Saudi Arabia and the oil flow from the Middle East. And the same geopolitical concern over Soviet domination of the Persian Gulf and its oil shaped the Eisenhower Doctrine.
The Middle East has abruptly reached a new and critical stage in its long and important history. If the nations of that area should lose their independence, if they were dominated by alien forces hostile to freedom, that would be both a tragedy for the area and for many other free nations whose economic life would be subject to near strangulation.
The oil flow from the Persian Gulf is so essential to American security and well-being that we'll do anything necessary to protect it.
If power-hungry communists should either falsely or correctly estimate that the Middle East is inadequately defended, they might be tempted to use open measures of armed attack. If so, that would start a chain of circumstances which would almost surely involve the United States in great military action.
These sorts of brazen announcements that the United States would use force to protect its interests continued right through to the Vietnam War.
We Americans are a do-it-yourself people. We're an impatient people. Instead of teaching someone else to do a job, we like to do it ourselves. And this trait has been carried over into our foreign policy.
But the Vietnam War made the American public very reluctant to send American troops into troubled third world countries. And Nixon was forced to change course.
When you are trying to assist another nation defend its freedom, U.S. policy should be to help them fight the war, but not to fight the war for them.
So we ended up with the Nixon Doctrine, which called for the United States to rely on proxy forces to defend American interests in these troubled third world areas.
For the Nixons, Tehran was different. The welcome was warm, full of pomp and enthusiasm.
In the Persian Gulf, the Nixon Doctrine was focused specifically on Iran, where the United States embraced the autocratic Shah of Iran to be our surrogate, our proxy. And it was the Shah who was chosen to protect U.S. interests in the Gulf area.
And now we come again to Tehran. And we see the progress that has occurred in those 19 years under the enlightened leadership of Your Majesty.
And we provided billions and billions of dollars to the Shah and to Iranian forces to protect the oil. And this surrogate strategy worked fine until the Shah of Iran was overthrown in 1979.
Suddenly, Iran is no longer one of this country's strongest and most dependable allies in the strategic Persian Gulf area.
The autocratic Shah was replaced by the Ayatollah Khomeini, who adopted an anti-American stance. This produced tremendous panic in Washington because there were no proxies left to defend the oil.
Mr. President, the Persian Gulf is one of the great mineral treasures of the whole world. Most of Japan's oil and an awful lot of Europe's oil passes through there. The Shah really was the policeman of the Gulf and kept the oil flowing. Now, the new civilian government says it's not going to be the policeman of the Gulf anymore. What's going to happen to this terribly, terribly important part of the world if there is no policeman?
And so it was decided that the United States would have to take up this role itself.